The 2013 World Food Prize is honoring three scientists whose individual discoveries led to the creation of genetically modified crops. This hour, we talk with them. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. By 2012, GMOs were grown on more than 420 million acres around the globe. 17 million farmers grow GMO crops, and over 90% of them are small, resource-poor farmers in developing countries. But GMOs remain controversial. Today, we'll hear from the 2013 World Food Prize laureates about their scientific work and have them answer concerns over GMOs. Join our conversation with your comments and questions. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. 2013 marks the 60th anniversary of the discovery of the double helix structure of the DNA molecule, that discovery by James Watson, Francis Crick, and Morris Wilkins. And that discovery in the 1950s was a huge breakthrough. My guests this hour, Mark Van Montague, Mary Dell Chilton, and Rob Fraley, each built on that huge breakthrough. They conducted groundbreaking molecular research on how a plant bacterium could be adapted, used as a tool to insert genes from another organism into plant cells, and that allowed them to produce new genetic lines. And these genetic lines had highly favorable traits. The 2013 World Food Prize is honoring these three scientists for their individual discoveries. By 2012, GMOs were grown on more than 170 million hectares around the globe. That's over 420 million acres. Over 17 million farmers grow them, and over 90% of these farmers are small, resource-poor farmers in developing countries. But GMOs remain controversial. And this is the first time the World Food Prize, a prestigious award in its 27 history, has paid homage to this controversial research. This hour, the three laureates are with us in our Des Moines studio to tell us about their scientific work, also to answer your concerns over GMOs. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. In our Des Moines studio, Mark Van Montague, founder and chairman of the Institute for Plant Biotechnology Outreach. That's located in Ghent, Belgium. Mark Van Montague, welcome to our program.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Mary Dell Chilton is with us, founder and distinguished science fellow, Syngenta Biotechnology, Inc. Mary Dell Chilton, welcome to you.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
And the third in our Des Moines studio, Rob Fraley, Executive Vice President and Chief Technology Officer with Monsanto. Rob Fraley, you joined us in June. Welcome back to the program.
Ben, great to be here again.
So I would like to, first of all, offer congratulations as the newest laureates of the World Food Prize.
Thank you very
much. To all three of you.
Thanks. Appreciate that.
And we want to spend the first few minutes understanding what you did. As I mentioned, this double helix structure of DNA molecules, this discovery is sort of the base, if I'm understanding this right, of all of your discoveries here. So if you could, in the first few minutes, each take us through your breakthroughs and how it relates to that original breakthrough and how yours relate to each other. And I think if we take them in order, you more or less build on each other's work. Mark Van Montague, would you be the first one to go then, right?
Yes, probably. I'm the oldest one, indeed.
Right.
So we were at the university in the 50s, so when we heard about these biological macromolecules that become more interesting than it was thought earlier. And then in the 60s, we tried to, with these tools, to understand the genetic code, understand how genes were regulated, and we did all the work with viruses that infect bacteria, this bacteriophage, and then in the late 60s, we decided we would look why bacteria make tumors on plants. And since everybody was working on viruses, we looked on the virus, but we found that there was a plasmid in one of the soil bacterium, Agrobacterium tumefaciens, as it was called in those days. And we saw that that was really responsible for the tumor-inducing principle, and that's how the story started.
Mm-hmm. So for you, your breakthrough moment was what?
Well, finding the TI plasmid, seeing that bacteria was determining some compounds that were present in the tumor, because this bacteria does natural genetic engineering. It forces a plant to make compounds that are good for the bacteria, not for the plants. And each bacteria could induce other compounds. So mm-hmm. it's clear the information must be in the bacteria.
And so the importance of that, help us understand that.
Well, the importance was that the bacteria could determine new characteristics in a plant. So the working hypothesis was that this bacteria was transferring genes and inserting genes. Many people laughed with us when we made this hypothesis, but it turned out to be true. And luckily, Maridel was always chasing us, and so we were not lazy. And together, we arrived at the fact that indeed it was genetic engineering and that it could be used in agriculture.
Okay.
But since we didn't know anything about agriculture, we needed other people who really take it up and that it be used.
Okay, so your work and you and your colleagues' work led to the development of the first sort of technology to stably transfer these foreign genes into plants. Maridel Chilton, can you pick up the story from there? Where did you take it, and in what way were you chasing Mark Van Montague and his colleagues?
Yeah, I think all three of us have chased each other.
Okay.
My piece of this began after Mark and his collaborators discovered this large plasmid in Agrobacterium. My team at the University of Washington in Seattle were very good at doing DNA experiments, and the plasmid, of course, is DNA. What we did is we demonstrated in a very labor-intensive kind of experiment, we demonstrated clearly that there was DNA, there was part of this plasmid in the plant cell, and most of it not, just a little piece of it, enough for maybe 4 or 5 genes.
Mm-hmm. And help me understand why that's important.
That was the demonstration that indeed the tumor-inducing principle that went from Agrobacterium into the plant was DNA from the bacteria. That had been suspected before, and some papers had been published that hinted around that. But we were the first to show it unequivocally that the DNA is there. Mm-hmm. The way we did it is very old-fashioned, and nobody does that kind of experiment
anymore. Yeah, what did it look like?
What did it look like?
Mm-hmm.
What?
How you did that? You said very labor-intensive experiments.
Oh, well, it was a lot of people sitting around constant temperature baths with little columns in them, little pipette columns, pouring in solutions and collecting them from the bottom of the column.
Okay.
It was the story is that we used radio-labeled DNA for this, and the radio-labeled DNA was so heavily labeled, so hot, that it would suicide itself if you let it sit in the refrigerator overnight. So our experiments would start the day we received the precursor from the company, and it would run all weekend long. The whole lab was there day and night running these little columns to watch the DNA reassociation rate, watch the Watson and Crick strands come together. Hmm. And the rate at which they did that told us that indeed the tumor cells had DNA in them from the bacterium.
Was there a moment in on this long process when you literally got a chill? You just saw something happen? Tell me about that moment.
That moment, I was sitting in my kitchen at the table with the tape from the tricarb radiation counter, looking at the counts from all these little columns. And I was plotting them out on graph paper with a pencil. And I saw, my God, it's there. It really is there. That was a moment.
You said it's there, but what did you see past there? It must have given you a glimpse into the future. What was that future?
What I saw was that the DNA was renaturing quicker when we added the tumor DNA to it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that rate told me that indeed there were copies of the labeled DNA in the plant cell.
Mary Dell Chilton, thank you for telling us a little bit about that, helping us begin to grasp what these very important discoveries are about. Now, I want to turn to you, Rob Fraley, because your early research built upon these discoveries, the discoveries of Mary Dell Chilton and Mark Van Montague, and you focused on inventing effective methods for gene transfer systems. Explain that.
Well, you've got it right. I think all science builds on the science that comes before us, and there were so many contributions and folks that you know made it all possible, and you know it was a special time for this field. I need to tell the story that Mary Dell was talking about the lab work. When I first moved to St. Louis to Monsanto, I had an appointment at Washington University in St. Louis, and Mary Dell and her team were showing me how to grow this agrobacterium and isolate these plasmids. And Mark and his colleague Jeff Schell were frequent visitors to the labs and back and forth. So we were all competing a little bit. We were collaborating a lot, and it was a special time for the field.
It was fun, was it not?
It was. And our team in St. Louis at Monsanto, and I really have to emphasize, it was a great team. Rob Horsch was our tissue culture expert, and Steve Rogers was our vector guy, and Ernie Jaworski was really a champion for what we were doing. And we focused on how do we take all these hints of opportunity to use this agrobacterium and then turn it into a system that would work. And we were able to really simultaneously kind of figure out how to use our agrobacterium, how to delete the genes on the TI plasmid that would cause trouble, introduce a new gene that could be a marker that could tell whether the genes were present, and then regenerate those plant cells into little plants. And it's kind of a funny story, but we were working in Monsanto in a company, but the plant that we were working on was petunia. So some of the world's first transgenic plants were petunia plants, and you can imagine that created quite a stir in the company. But exciting times, and it really opened the door for a lot of the crop improvements and a lot of the benefits that you were talking about.
Okay, I very briefly summarize how many farmers in the world are using this. How many fields use some of the crops developed with the help of your discoveries before we have to take a break in about 2 or 3 minutes.
I want to
have you give us an idea of the length and breadth of the impact that this has had on the world. Can you do that, Rob?
Sure. For me, it's been breathtaking. The first biotech crops, the Roundup Ready soybeans and the Bolgard cottons were launched in 96, and today those crops are being grown in 30 countries around the world by tens of millions of farmers, and it's exciting. Think about it this way: within a short period of time, almost 25% of the world's cropland is using biotechnology, and farmers are adopting these tools because it improves their yields, it reduces their costs, it reduces their risks, and I would have never believed back in the early 80s that we would have seen this type of impact of technology on farmers all around the world.
Mark Van Montague, did you realize the impact that you would have when you started this work? And we have to mention, you grew up in Belgium during the Second World War, and this was a time when there was food rationing post-war, hardship all around the country. Did you know the impact you would have when you first made this technology to transfer foreign genes into plants?
Surely not, because we were interested in fundamental research, so we saw in it a tool to understand plant growth development, to study a plant genome. We knew there could be applications, but we didn't know about agriculture. Well, luckily, in the States, there were a lot of start-up companies that came, and they asked us. So then we realized that it had an economic value, and then we we could convince our government that we also would make a startup company, plant genetic systems, and that we would try some applications. So we could do the first BT plants and herbicide resistant, and then we saw it, yes, agriculture will need it. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, we are at the same time still unhappy since it's World Food Prize that for World Food, meanwhile, the disinformation was spreading so rapidly so that at the moment it's mostly feed, animal feed, and industrial plants that are grown. It's important for income for the farmers, but so much more could be done. And we okay. are so frustrated that that is not happening.
Okay, Mark Van Montague, Mary Dell Chilton, and Rob Fraley, please stay with us. We'll be back after a short break to talk about with our 2013 World Food Prize laureates to talk about genetically modified crops. Your conversation is also desired. Your concerns, comments, 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. A lot of controversy, of course, surrounding GMOs. We'll talk about that when we return. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In our Des Moines studio this hour, we have the 2013 World Food Prize laureates, Mark Van Montague, Rob Fraley, and Mary Dell Chilton. They are sharing the prize this year for their individual discoveries that have led to the creation of genetically modified crops, and we'd like to have you join our conversation. Let me mention here that these three laureates will be speaking in a public lecture tonight at 8 p.m. in the Memorial Union's Great Hall. It's at Iowa State University in Ames. Tomorrow, they'll be in Iowa City at 1:30 in the afternoon at the Old Capitol Senate Chamber to celebrate the World Food Prize this year. If you'd like to join our conversation for the next few minutes, your comments, questions, concerns about the scientific work of this year's World Food Prize laureates, 1-866-780-9100. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Let me start off promising this hour, because, of course, this is the first time that the World Food Prize has, in its 27-year history, that it has honored something that is, I think, so controversial, certainly in this area. And I'd like the three of you to react to one of your critics who is at the World Food Prize. She'll be at the this week. Frances Moore LaPay, a co-founder of the Small Planet Institute, among the panelists at the World Food Prize. She was, quote, extremely disappointed in the foundation selection this year of you as this year's winners. And I'd like you to react to this criticism specifically. Let me sort of capture that criticism. Genetically modified crops, she said, focus too much attention on output while making agriculture overly dependent on the agribusiness giants that produce the seed. Here's a direct quote from her. We are already producing enough food to feed us all. We know how to produce that food without taking the kind of risk that genetically modified crops represent, even if they are a small risk. Biotechnology, in her words, diverts us into still believing that the real problem and the solution is that we're somehow missing a particular technology or a particular pesticide or fertilizer. End of quote. Who would like to tackle that critic, Frances Moore LaPay?
Well, I never met her, but it will be a pleasure to talk to her, because I think there is so much misunderstanding and so much disinformation around that the only thing we can do is try to understand the beliefs she has, the feelings she has, and show what is the rationality behind it. At the moment, it's clear if we were in 45 with 2 billion people, and now we go straight to 8, 9, maybe 10, we have to find quite some solutions. Maybe we make food, but we have to do it in a sustainable way, and there is food and feed. And at the moment, even in India, half of the population is underfed, has problems. There is so much poverty. And the poverty and the hunger are linked. and we cannot solve it. Yes, there is a lot of rich people, but there are only many poor people. Would you say that it is correct? So we have to see. It's a problem of governance, but mostly bringing science and technology that the people can have better yields on the spot, and especially for the crops they need. All what has been done till now is some imported crops that's very good for the economy and for helping the richer countries, but the poorer countries still need a lot of applications. And it is the people who make this opposition that really block that development, because if there is opposition, then there are all kind of rules that come in and the files become very expensive, and they are responsible that exactly the orphan crops are not handled and that the products these people need are not handled. So that's a first reaction, but mm-hmm. we cannot solve it in 30 seconds all these stories, so it will be a pleasure to meet her.
Mark Van Montague, let's go perhaps to Marydale Chilton. How do you understand that criticism as a misunderstanding by Francis Moore LaPaix, who's been studying this and speaking out on this for decades?
I really don't understand the opposition to this technology. People say that it's not green, but it seems to me that the organic food should include genetically modified crops. I mean, it's a technology that, for one thing, reduces, and for another thing, in many cases, eliminates the need for some agricultural chemicals. So it reduces the impact of modern agriculture on the environment. And that can only be a good thing from my point of view.
Let me paraphrase a caller who left behind a message. He alleges biotechnology does not benefit the family farmer, but larger corporate farms, and raises concerns about the health of GMOs and the monopoly that corporations have on this technology. So, and I'll just throw into that comment that biotech seed sales to agricultural distributors, according to the information that I have, the research firm Cropnosis had an 11% rise in 2012 to nearly $15 billion. This is a huge industry. How do you address the critics, Rob Fraley, that this is not going to benefit the family farmer, but is really working only in the interests of corporate farms and corporate suppliers?
Great. And let me add on to both Mark and Mary Dell's comments. And I always like to start with talking about the safety of these products, because that's been top of mind from the very beginning of this science. And one of the things that I hear, and it was you'd paraphrased her comments, is it needs to start with the reality that this is a very, very specific type of genetic modification. And man has been, genetically modifying crops and farm animals since the beginning of time. And all of the research that's been done, both for the regulatory bodies around the world and for so many independent scientists, there's literally been thousands of studies and reports that point to the safety of the technology, and it's been affirmed by so many government bodies, including the AMA and healthcare bodies. And one of the things I'm the proudest about, before break we talked about the dramatic adoption of the technology, but I am so proud of the track record of safety the technology has. I mean, this technology has been in the marketplace for 20 years, and there is not a single incident of food or feed safety associated with the technology. I mean, that's a track record that I would take for any technology. There's no doubt that these are the most thoroughly studied and safest food products on the marketplace. The second area of misconception is the farmers and their interest in adoption of the technology. And maybe I have a different perspective because I grew up on a farm, and I can remember my dad and my neighbors, that seed decision was a very, very important one that they took seriously. And the reason farmers have adopted these new tools is because it gives farmers the opportunity to improve their yields, which improves their profitability. And as Mary Dell said, it reduces pesticide and chemical use. And farmers are the are the greatest stewards, and nobody knows their land better than them.
When I
hear people say that, you know, farmers don't benefit or they're being coerced somehow to use the technology, I can tell you that that's just absolutely false. I mean, farmers are making these decisions very carefully. They're smart businessmen or women, and they're doing it because it improves their operations.
Let me give one specific criticism. There are lots of areas of critics, but here's one, and it relates to what you just said, Rob Fraley. Food and Water Watch point out that it's an organization that is critical of GMOs, point out that the development of Roundup-ready corn and soybeans has led to an increase in the use of glyphosate, if I said that correctly, which has in turn led to the development of herbicide-resistant weeds. Now, that's another problem that's been created, right? How can that be combated?
The Roundup-ready technology, you know, has used Roundup as a key herbicide, but the part that often gets forgotten in that is the overall benefit has been a net reduction of chemical use because it's enabled for substitution of other products. And net-net, all of the independent studies that have been conducted over the years show that on average, biotech crops use about 20% less pesticides than non-biotech crops just because of the substitution. And yeah, you're exactly right. There have been a few weeds that have become resistant to Roundup, but those are easily addressed with farmers' agronomic practice. And, you know, the evolution of new weeds and new bugs is a constant part of agriculture, and it's a constant challenge for farmers, and it's one of the reasons that the continued investment in science and innovation is so critical to the future. You know, the last point that I just want to make sure, because I can't let it go without a response, is I think that the demand for technologies and solutions for food security are far, far greater than what was represented. You know, today, as Mark said, we've got 7.2 billion people. You know, the UN just revised upward the population targets by 2050 to be 9.6 billion. That's a third increase in population, but that triggers a doubling in the demand for food production. And that means the world has to produce more food, you know, by 2050 than we have in the entire history of mankind. I think the challenges of food security, when you consider that demand, when you consider climate change and evolving pests, just like you talked about, is the greatest challenge facing humanity today. And I can't believe anybody would not, you know, discuss that in the context of the need for innovations. We simply can't afford to farm the same way in 2050 without the new tools that are possible from the advances in biology and information technology. They're absolutely critical.
We have about 10 minutes left with our 2013 World Food Prize laureates. Rob Fraley, you heard just there, of Monsanto. Mary Dell Chilton, founder and distinguished science fellow at Syngenta Biotechnology, Inc. And Mark Van Montague, founder and chairman of the Institute for Plant Biotechnology Outreach in Ghent, Belgium. Let's try to squeeze in as many calls, some input from our listeners in the remaining less than 10 minutes. Let's go to George in Churden. Hi, George. Please make it brief, your question or comment.
Okay. Yeah. I'm a corn and soybean farmer farming for 37 years. I chose not to raise genetically modified crops. And I think your guests, they just repeat the same unjustified claims for genetically modified crops over and over again, even though they're not justified by science. They should really get out of the boardrooms and out of their labs and go visit people that are hungry.
Can you give us a specific?
My neighbors who are using more herbicides than ever.
Yeah.
More herbicides than ever, and the same companies come out with new products like dicamba-resistant soybeans and corn now, so that we will be using more chemicals to kill weeds.
You see it as a never-ending cycle. It sounds like, George.
Well, absolutely, and enriches these huge corporations, and it makes farmers even poorer because it intensifies the competition between farmers.
Okay, George in Churden, thank you. We've got your criticism. Let's get an answer. Responses. Who wants to tackle that in Des Moines?
Well, I think the one thing I would agree with is that the challenges that farmers face are continually increasing, and you know we're going to continue to see the challenges as the climate change and pests evolve. The point where I really differ is, you know, again, I grew up on a farm in central Illinois, and I visit and talk with farmers around the world, and I'm terribly impressed by the decision-making that they do, the knowledge they have of their operations. Farmers have lots of choices, and just like this farmer decided not to grow biotechnology or GMO crops, that's great. But there are tens of millions of farmers who have chosen to do that because of the benefits that they provide, and those benefits are very real, and those are decisions that farmers have made you know, in the best interest of their farming operations.
Let's go to Bill in Sac City. Hi, Bill.
Oh, hi, and thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure thing, Bill.
Dr. Norman Borlaug, in his acceptance speech for the Nobel Prize, indicated there is a twofold goal to end world hunger, and they are, the first, increase food production, second, decrease the growth of the world's population. And the world's population, as you mentioned just a little earlier, is to increase from 6 to 9 billion by 2050. And when you address the increase in food production but do nothing about population growth, you are creating a problem rather than solving one. My question is, why do researchers ignore the second of these as proposed by Dr. Norman Borlaug? And my contention is that the World's Food Prize is a misnomer. It should be named the Sustainable Prize. And what I would appreciate what's your input.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bill, thank you from Sac City. Let's address that. The other half of the equation, as Bill sees it.
Yes, I think it's absolutely right. We have to see why this population increase is there. And then we see it's at the basis of it is poverty. People, the farmers in the developing countries, they have no social security. There's only their children that will take care of them when they are old. So we are, that's why in the Rio Plus 20 and already in the Millennium Goals, people say fight poverty and fight hunger, because that goes absolutely together. So we have to make structures that this can be done. And at that moment, if there is more confidence and if the farmers have some income, they will use it to bring more knowledge and take the children to school, and they have to have a better society. And altogether, we have to think about what this means, world solidarity at the level of the different types of communities we have. And that is, at that moment, indeed, do it together with the way we look at nature. And so then we come to the more sustainable agriculture. And at the moment, indeed, the World Food Prize is at the same time a prize for more sustainable agriculture. But that will be linked to the science and technology that can be used, and not by cutting off these people from the science and technology.
Mary Dell Chilton, let me hear from you, because yeah. Bill had the point of perhaps trying to rename it the Sustainability Prize. How do you see your work and the work of your two colleagues sitting with you fitting into the future of sustainable agriculture?
I want to go back to the previous question just a moment, if I may, and comment that I fully agree with what color Bill, I believe he is.
Bill in Sac City, yes.
Yeah, I fully agree with what he says. And in that spirit, I am going to give my my third of the World Food Prize to Planned Parenthood. So that shows you where my heart is on this subject.
Are you just announcing that now, or did you announce that beforehand?
Well, I haven't kept it a secret.
Okay, very good. Let's talk a little bit. Rob, did you have anything to say on that point?
But yeah, Bill's... I would just say that Norm Borlaug, was a personal hero, and I had a chance to spend a lot of time with him the last years of his life. And Norm always made a couple of points to me. The first one was that that hunger never sleeps, and the implication was that farmers can't sleep either, and they're going to continue to need new tools and technologies to meet the demand. But the other important part, which I think Mark echoed, and it was one of Norm's key points, was when you're helping farmers, it's a double win because you're producing more food, but farmers represent the bulk of the rural poor. So as you improve their operations, their profitability, and I've seen this around the world, you improve lifestyle and you address birth rate.
And yet much of the criticism of GMOs has been because seed companies hold the patents for the seeds, that the inputs are too expensive for poor farmers to be profitable using GMOs. So justify the use of patents when developing technology to combat world hunger.
It's very easy. I mean, and you talked about it earlier. 90% of the farmers who are growing biotech crops are smallholders, and those technologies provide a benefit. In fact, all the analysis and studies have been done show that the smaller grower who maybe doesn't have the tractor, who doesn't have the modern spray equipment, benefits the most because you've taken the latest technology and you've built those attributes into the seed. And the seeds are basically scale neutral because every farmer in the world knows what to do with the seed. So the barriers to adoption are very low. And that's really one of the incredible benefits that this science has. And I am so proud of the fact that that the technology has reached farmers, you know, across China, across India, across now parts of Africa and South America that are smallholders.
We have just a couple minutes left. Mark Van Montague, I want to ask you again, because you seem to see it's a big misunderstanding, the critics of GMOs. You don't understand why there is it. But if the concerns about GMOs don't amount to much, why do you believe there is so much controversy? Is it that what's behind it, do you think, then?
I think we should talk more with sociologists and people who have studied human behavior. We are so taken by our beliefs. And there is a track record on all kind of innovation in science. Somebody wants to tell scare stories, and then people in the first place believe the scary stories. And if people are giving false information, like some groups are really doing, and I think there's a long list of facts that are told about the Indian farmers that commit suicide, and it is not going up, it's going down. The fact that it gives tumors on rats, like Seralini says, that was all over the press in Europe, and people are afraid. So we can understand that science, if people are not discussing it, and that they emotionally have beliefs against it. But people should start analyzing how they make decisions. And we will see, all of us, we all make decisions based on beliefs. And it's too slow that you really use science, technology, and the rationality of it. And together we have to learn to do that. And then we will see that the science is needed there, but we can cherish all the emotions we have through beliefs, but that should not interfere, and there is no reason why this should interfere.
Mark Van Montague, thank you very much for coming into our studio. Founder and chairman of the Institute for Plant Biotechnology Outreach in Belgium, Mary Dell Chilton, founder and distinguished science fellow at Syngenta Biotechnology, Inc., and Rob Fraley, executive vice president and chief technology officer at Monsanto, the 2013 World Food Prize laureates. Not nearly enough time to cover many of these aspects in depth, but we appreciate you coming into our studio, answering some of your critics, and having this conversation. Thank you very much, and once again, congratulations on the World Food Prize.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.